Good morning. Let's try that again. I want to know you're all awake before I put you to sleep. Good morning. I didn't hear you. And you have a microphone. You're already asleep. That's why Jonathan plays so enthusiastically, because when he plays softly, he falls asleep. Let's remember from Joshua. Let's remember from Moses. Let's remind ourselves from the Lord what the Israelites are supposed to do when they get in the land. Number one, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. That was their commandment. Two, in utter humility before Him. That means recognizing who He is and recognizing who you are. In utter humility before Him, obey Him. Obey Him. Three, do not compromise with and do not tolerate the principles, the system of those who are in the land. In fact, destroy it. Tear it all down. Four, drive out all the inhabitants of the land completely. Number five, remember what the Lord your God has done and teach your children well. Tell them, live by faith, not by sight, because the life of faith is the life of victory. That is what they're supposed to do. And you have these two incredibly sad verses sort of bookend the book of Judges. Think about this. Think about this in your life, in your family, and in this church. Think about this. Judges chapter 2, verse 10 says, there arose another generation after them. Now, we're talking about 80 years since they've come out of Egypt, and maybe 40 years or so since they've come into the land. A generation arose after them who did not know the Lord, nor yet the work which He had done for Israel. How sad is that? How scary is that? Then we have this other bookend, Judges 21, 25. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in their own sight. Worshipped their opinions. Did what they wanted to do. Did what they thought was right. Does that sound familiar? In Judges chapter 1, verses 1 through chapter 3, verses 6, you have several little brief recapitulatory overviews, summaries of the cycles, several different kinds of cycles that we're going to look at in the book of Judges. You have the background or the setting of what we are going to be seeing and reading in the book of Judges. How many of you read Judges chapter 3 this week? Okay, good. I'm happy with that. Good, good, good. I want to give you their overview. These are important to sort of keep in mind. There's about six of them, okay? Are you ready? You still with me? You haven't nodded off yet? Overview number one. I'm giving you the land to possess as your own. I will rid all of the inhabitants of the land before you. You just need to walk behind me and obey me. Live by faith, not by sight. That's overview number one. That's what's supposed to happen. That's a backdrop to what we're seeing in the book of Judges. Overview number two. Things went very, very well under Joshua and Caleb and the leaders, their contemporaries, the leaders of that generation. And then God tells Joshua, kind of getting old, there's a lot left to be done. So Joshua takes and divides the land into the 12 tribes and tells their leaders, finish the work that I've started. Finish what I've begun. Go and do it as I have done it. As I've shown you, you do it. Okay? Overview number three. They don't. That's real simple. Two words. They don't. They fail. They choose to live by sight rather than by faith. Overview number four. The progression of sin. This is what this looks like. in their life, in the life of the nation. And by the way, this is what it looks like in your life. You allow the enemy to remain. You allow the enemy to remain. You think, they thought, you can have power. You can control the enemy. You can subdue the enemy. You can use the enemy. You can use that system of the enemy to benefit yourself. You imitate the enemy. Start copying them. And then you embrace the enemy. Start being a part of it. And then the enemy owns you. The enemy enslaves you. That is the progression of sin that this nation of Israel followed in the land of Canaan, and that is the progression of sin that each of us follows. Overview number five. God said, I told you what would happen if you disobey me. I warned you, I warned you, I warned you, I warned you, I warned you. How many times through how many people I told you what would happen. Now, these people that you have allowed to remain are going to be a thorn in your side, and I am going to use them to teach you. I'm going to use them to teach you. In other words, it sounds to me as though God is saying, you didn't learn the easy way. How many of us have been there? You have to learn the hard way. A few of us are a little bit more stubborn. I saw a hand go up like this. It's just kind of subtle. Have to learn the hard way. Last overview. This is the big cycle that we're going to see. The people disobey. God removes his hand of blessing and imparts his hand of discipline. The people fall into despair. And by the way, you got to notice, it's not because of their sin. It's because of the consequences of their sin. And they cry out because of the oppression or the repression or the enslavement, and then God delivers them by sending a judge. We'll see if you learned, okay? Disobedience, discipline, despair, deliverance. Disobedience, discipline, despair, and disobedience. And it begins over, we're going to look at this cycle several times this summer. One more thing before we get into this morning's sermon. Ready? I want you to understand the system that the people in the land of Canaan are engaged in. I want you to be familiar with this before we go through this summer. You need to understand the gods that the inhabitants of the land worshipped. You need to understand the system that the Israelites begin to participate in, and you really need to understand the system that comes to own the Israelites. Just like in Egypt, the people of the land of Canaan believe in a pantheon, a plurality of gods, many gods for many areas of their lives. Chief among the gods in the land of Canaan is Baal and his mistress, Asherah. Baal and Asherah. Baal literally means, Baal literally means the son of God. You find that interesting like I do? You find that fascinating? Amen, brother. Thank you. Can I get a witness? Wait, I just went to a whole other place. I think he just said, God, Jesus. I don't know about you, but that's what I heard. Baal literally means the son of God. And Baal is seen as the protector, their provider. Baal is, if you'll remember before, the god of the storm. They hear the voice of Baal in thunder. And they see the mighty hand of Baal in lightning. Baal gives them bodies of water and rivers to protect their borders, to protect the people he supposedly loves. He gives them rain to sustain their life. That's who they think this son of God is. And Ashtoreth, his mistress, is the goddess of luxury and indulgence. So he provides and he protects, and she lets you enjoy yourself. The worship of these two is absolutely the most detestable, debaucherous form of worship you can imagine. It looks a little like this. The priests of Baal and Asherah dance around in this chaotic, frantic, intoxicated like stupor. Loud shouts and yelling and beseeching of Baal and Asherah. And they take knives and sharp stones and they slash and cut and slash and cut. They mutilate their own bodies. All the while, participants are ritually engaged with male and female prostitutes. And parents are encouraged to sacrifice their firstborn children, their firstborn sons particularly, by taking them by the feet and bashing their heads against a rock. And then burning their bodies on altars. All of this is going on. All of this is ritually taking place. This is the form of worship for Baal and Asherah in the view, publicly, out there for everybody to either participate in or revel in watching. Now, I know that may be shocking to you. It might be hard for you to imagine a culture that indulges in the destruction of the mind, a culture that indulges in the destruction, the mutilation of the body, a culture that indulges in sexual immorality, a culture that indulges in the murder of children, all for the sake of personal well-being, personal blessing, convenience, to feel good. It might be hard to imagine. It might not. This is the fundamental system of the people in the land. And to that system, you are going to add the Philistines. Now, the Philistines are these Aegean people. They come from across the sea. And they bring with them their chief deity. Does anyone know his name? Dagon. Dagon. He is the father of the gods. So you bring the Philistines into the land and their systems of worship sort of match up really well because they have Baal, the son of God, and they have Dagon, the father of the gods. And that system merges. This should be abhorrent to the Israelites. This should either cause them to, in shock, run and hide their eyes, or in anger, as God said, tear this stuff all down, destroy it, burn it to ashes. But instead it allures them. Oh, blessing. It entices them. Oh, feel good and indulgence. It enslaves them. There are three scenarios that we read about, you should have read about in chapter 3. First, Judges 3:7 says this, "The sons of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord." And by the way, don't take those two phrases apart from each other. What's right in their own eyes and what's evil in his. "And they forgot the Lord their God and served the Baals and the Ashtoreth. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel." Kindle, think about that word. I was kindling some things yesterday to grill out. There's a little ember, there's a little ember. And it stokes it and the fire begins and it gets hot and then it's ablaze. So think of God's anger like that. As he's watching this and that ember starts and it's stoked and there's air being poured out on this and then it's blazing. God's anger. And he uses a Hittite warrior king named Cushan. Or Cushan. Cushan. The Hittites were the third most powerful and influential people group in the Middle East behind Egypt and Mesopotamia. And under this king, Cushan, the Hittites conquer and they take control of Mesopotamia. And they sweep down from the north and enslave Israel. So now you have Israel enslaved by the second most powerful kingdom in the Middle East, just behind Egypt. And from a historical point of view, it seems as though the intent of this Hittite Mesopotamian king is to come down and strike at the heart, strike at Egypt. And Israel's just sort of along the way. The king's name literally means Cushan of double wickedness. Cushan of double wickedness. This guy is so bad, his bad is bad. You understand? This guy is downright nasty. And he's conquered all of Mesopotamia. He sweeps down and enslaves Israel, and he has them enslaved for 8 years. The second scenario, Judges 3:12. Now the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord. And this time, God uses a Moabite king named Eglon. And this king, Eglon, has an alliance with the Ammonites and the Amalekites. And they defeat Israel. And what's interesting here is that the Moabites and the Amorites are the descendants of Lot. Remember Lot? Abraham had a brother. His brother had a son. Abraham and Lot, his nephew. The Amalekites are the descendants of Esau. Remember Esau? Jacob and Esau? Okay. King Eglon sees a strategic significance in this capturing of Israel with the city of Jericho, what's called, as you read it, the city of palms, the city of Jericho. God said, you don't rebuild the fortifications of this city. But they've rebuilt the city and left it open and unfortified, undefended. Eglon comes in and he sets up his capital, his palace, there in Jericho. Remember how strategic Jericho is at the crossroads of that ancient world. By the way, in 1933, archaeologists discover what they believe is Eglon's palace in Jericho. It's about the size of this sanctuary. Supposedly very beautiful. Third, you have the Philistines. These Aegean Sea people. They have five cities, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, on the coastline of Israel, okay? What's interesting about them is they have this constant, I don't know, what you call bullying, raiding, taunting, you know, poke sort of relationship with the Israelites. And while the people like the Hittites and the Philistines have iron weapons, very strong. They're much stronger than the weapons the Israelites have. It's the Philistines who purposefully, intentionally prevent Israel from obtaining the knowledge or the use of iron. 1 Samuel 13:19 says this, "Now no blacksmith could be found in all the land of Israel, for the Philistines said, otherwise the Hebrews will make swords and spears." So there's this repression going on. So God is quite literally saying, you believe that this system around you, you believe that the system of the land can provide for you. You believe that the system of this culture around you can protect you. You believe that the system can bless you. Well, have it. Go ahead and have it. because it will not provide, protect, and bless you. It will repress you, it will oppress you, and it will enslave you. And when the repression and the oppression and the slavery overwhelms them, they finally cry out. And God sends a deliverer. This stuff is so fascinating. Othniel, the son of Kenaz. We first meet Othniel in Joshua chapter 15. How many of you remember that encounter with Othniel? Remember Joshua and Caleb? Caleb has a daughter. Some of you just went like, do you remember Joshua and Caleb? Yes, we do. Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. Caleb has a daughter, and they're in this battle. They're taking the land. They're conquering here. And Caleb says, I will give my daughter's hand in marriage to any warrior who can take the city of Debir. Othniel comes up, like, check her out, you know? And he goes, boom, and he takes Debir. And he marries Caleb's daughter. That's who Othniel is. The Spirit of the Lord came upon him, and he judged Israel. And he went out to war, and the Lord gave Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Mesopotamia, into his hands so that he prevailed over Cushan-Rishathaim, Cushan of double wickedness. That's Othniel. And then you have Ehud, a left-handed man, the son of Gera, the Benjamite. Now, this is very interesting. This is sort of one of those weird things. The word that we have translated in English, left-handed, is actually a Hebrew word that means right-hand bound. So it doesn't actually say left-handed, it means right-hand bound. Okay? Right-hand bound. Now, on top of that, we know that the tribe of Benjamin was particularly known for being a people who were either left-handed or ambidextrous. Or my wife says ambidextrous. My wife knows how to pronounce these things better. So that nature of being left-handed, left-handed pitchers, left-handed hitters, you understand? This nature of being left-handed gives an advantage over right-handed people in confrontation. Southpaws in boxing. Do you understand? There's an advantage to being a left-handed person when it comes to confrontation. In fact, Judges chapter 20 describes 700 Benjamites, there's something in their DNA, as warriors, choice men who were left-handed. Think about this. Each one could sling a stone at a hare and not miss. I can't sling a stone at the side of a barn and, you know, sling a stone at a hare and not miss. These people are very, very skilled. Now, yeah, either Ehud is disabled in his right hand and forced to use his left, or Ehud is simply left-handed, or he might be ambidextrous like those many in his tribe, but more than that, this guy is unbelievably strategic. We're reading through this. And Joanna says, this sounds like a mob hit. This is amazing. This is the first organized crime assassination in recorded history. He makes a short sword. Depending on the translations and what the actual measurements of their time were to ours, it's somewhere between 18 and 20 inches long. From point to hilt, from point to pummel. 18 inches long, 20 inches long. And he ties this to the inside of his right thigh. This is a place where it's not going to be found in a normal search, a normal pat-down for meeting a king, for going into a king's presence. And he goes to pay tribute. This is what Eglon is doing. He's taxing them to death, taxing them to death. All of the plunder that they work for, all the excess that they might have in their crops and fields, and even some of their necessities, Eglon takes for himself, and they go to pay it at Jericho. So he's going to bring this taxation to this king. He's an emissary of his people. And after he hands over this plunder, he tells the king, I have a special message for you from God, you know? So the king feels safe with Ehud. Obviously, no weapon has been found, and he dismisses the rest of the attendants so that it's just Ehud, the judge, and Eglon, the king, in there. Now, this king is, as the Bible says, a fat man. This man is a very obese man. Now, I tried this week, by the way. I'm a big guy, right? You're afraid? You scared? Go ahead, say it. Come on. I stood up against the wall, and I got a ruler, okay, a tape measure. And I am about 13 and a half, 13 and three quarter inches from back to front. Big guy. 18 to 20 inch blade. Now think about this. The king stands. This guy's a really, really big guy. This guy is two, if not two and a half of me. He stands to receive this important message from God. And Ehud, with his left hand, grabs his dagger off his right thigh and plunges. And what a strike is this. Boom! Into this man's gut. So much so that the point of the blade starts to come out this man's back. But the hilt, the pommel, the whole handle is engulfed in this man's front. What a blow is struck. You know? Sound effects in this church are great. King falls dead. Ehud locks the doors to the chamber from the inside and quietly gets out the back window. And he goes to a place where he feels he's safe, blows a trumpet, and all the men that he has stationed around come in and besiege Jericho and besiege his palace, and they wipe out all of this man's men. It says 10,000 of them, and it says not one was spared, not one escaped. What a story. And then you have this guy Shamgar of Anath. Now, we don't know a whole lot about Shamgar. Son of Anath is confusing because Anath is a Canaanite deity. It's one of their pantheon. Anath is a Canaanite god, Anath. Okay? But it's also the name of a place, a name of a city in the tribe of Naphtali, Beth, the place of, or the Beth Anath. So this guy Shamgar, he could have come from this city, or named after the city that he came from in the tribe of Naphtali, or he could have come from a family that is so indoctrinated into the religion of this country, the religion of the Canaanites, that they named him after one of the Canaanite deities. But we do know from Judges chapter 5, verse 6, that he is a contemporary with some great names. He's a contemporary with Jael. He's a contemporary with Barak. He is a contemporary with Deborah. This man is being used by God. Now, remember the Philistines who won't let the Israelites have any iron weapons and disarm the Israelites? Disarmament, in general, is the rule of the day. If you're going to come in and take over a land, you're going to take away all their weapons so they can't fight back. Disarmament is always step one in repression, oppression, and slavery. Disarm them. So here he is. What are you going to use? Got no swords, got no spears. Certainly don't have anything that's iron and can fight against you. He has, now imagine this, an 8 foot long, so I'm 6'1", bring you up, I don't know, what is it, 2.5 feet? 3 feet, okay, an 8 foot long pole. And on one end, it has a metal sharpened point. And on the other hand, it has a metal flat spade. Now, the sharpened point is to prod or to direct the ox in the path that you want it to take. And the spade is to clean off the hoof of the ox after it's walked through the dirt and the mud. So think about this tool that he has. Just let your mind wander for a second. Prod and purify. Direct and clean is the tool that Shamgar is using. He struck down 600 Philistines with this ox goat. Now, there are some people that think it took place in some sort of modern-day computer-animated martial arts genre. People flying through the air. Can you imagine that pole spinning back and forth and hopping from tent to tent, you know? I tend to think it probably took place in more of a covert assassination process. So just imagine, quick, pow, very effective, very lethal. And then back in the field with the animals and the dirt, as if nothing happened, unsuspected. Who killed Bob? No one knows, you know. Who killed Steve? The bodies are starting to pile up. No one knows. How could they do this? They don't have any weapons. They're just a bunch of farmers. No one knows. That's what I think is going on there. A couple of things I want you to consider as we wrap up this morning. God can do anything with anyone at any time he wants. And that's the point. You have the skilled warrior from a prominent family being used here. You have a person that's either disabled or disadvantaged, or maybe just simply different being used here. And you have a person who's rather obscure, sort of unknown, with very, very little at their disposal being used here. Who are you? Summer challenge number one. Summer challenge number two. Who are you? Are you the powerful? Are you the prominent one? Are you the disabled? Are you the disadvantaged? Are you simply different? Are you unknown? Are you poor? Who are you? The point is, it doesn't matter who you are or where you come from or what you have at your disposal. All that matters is God and God's word and God's will and obedience to it. What's the result of God? What do you want more than anything else in your life right now? Someone give me the word. Peace. What has every human being from all times, from all around the world, ever really wanted deep in their heart? Peace, rest, calm, contentment, order, tranquility, harmony, wholeness, fullness, completion, safety, security, and favor. Verse 11, what's the result of God? Then the land had peace. 40 years. What's the result of God? Verse 30. The land had peace for 80 years. What's the result of God? Verse 31, Israel was saved. I hope you understand the application that you are supposed to focus on like a laser beam this summer. God says, obey me, follow me, trust me, love me. God says, do not tolerate the system of the world and the culture around you. Do not compromise with it. God says, don't believe that anything in this system can provide for you, can protect you, can bless you, can give you peace. In fact, while you cannot achieve for yourself righteousness or godliness, it is imparted to you. Your job in this thing is to rid yourself of sin. Shake it off, throw it out, tear it off, and throw it away. Rid yourself of sin and everything that hinders, everything that entangles, everything that holds you back. What pocket of sin are you allowing to remain in your life, in your family, or in your church? What pocket of this system, what pocket of the system are you trying to use, thinking you can rule over it? Are you trying to use for your benefit? I'm telling you, brothers and sisters, I'm shocked sometimes. What voices are you listening to? What voices are you listening to? What people are you listening to? What perspectives? What principles are you allowing to shape your worldview? People that love you or people who love the Lord or people who love themselves? What philosophies are you embracing? What are you obeying? Here, let's boil it all down. Let's boil it all down. And you know the answer to this because the Holy Spirit is not lazy. What has been repressing you? What's been draining you? What's been oppressing you? Holding you back? What's been enslaving you recently or for years?